Welcome to another edition of the Untold Patriots Stories podcast with Scott Prusak and Dave Usher, where you'll hear stories told by the players and media members.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Untold Patriots Stories podcast. I'm Scott Prusak, along with Dave Usher. Our guest tonight has been on sports TV and radio host who has dominated the airwaves on 98.5 for over a decade. Also, one of Marconi can be heard from 2 to 6 Monday through Friday, and also can be seen on NBC Sports Boston with co-host Michael Hawley. Also wrote a book, Tales from the Patriot Sideline, forwarded by Steve Grogan and Bill Belichick for the first 40 years of the franchise. I wanted to welcome tonight Michael Felger.
How you guys doing?
Good evening, Mike. How are you?
Good evening. Good to be here.
All right. Good. Thank you for taking some time out. I'm going to turn it over to Dave and we can get this thing going.
I feel like I've dreamt about this moment, be able to rebut Michael Felger on the radio. But you know, he talked about your book, and it's really right up our alley. We talk about Untold Patriot Stories, and yours is Tales from the Patriot Sidelines. Very similar. I'm not going to say you stole it because yours was first. There's so many great topics in there. But, you know, one of the things that stands out to me is the cyclical nature of the ownership, at least for the first 40 years, went through some of you called it the BS times with the Sullivans and then with Kyam, et cetera. Are we at a point now where ownership's starting to go back in that groove with what they're doing with Belichick? And
no, I mean, okay. not that bad. I mean, come on. Like I have some problems with the Crafts, so I think the Crafts are worthy of some second guessing and some criticism for sure. To compare them to Victor Kyam is that's doing the Crafts a disservice. We're not, you know, or some of the dysfunction of the Sullivan ownership. And, you know, I like the Sullivans a lot and Pat Sullivan. I think there was a good family and those were good people. And I think they did some good things. So I don't think that they're the complete debacle that some people want to portray them as. That being said, the Crafts are still another level of ownership. And I think their methods are going to be put to the test. But we're not talking about that rank level of dysfunction that existed in those previous years. We're not there.
Good.
Well, so this is, and you know, this is how we put it on the radio the other day. You know, previous to the Crafts, the Patriots organization, the brand, was at the bottom of the sports world, you know, in terms of brand equity and the quality of the organization. Like, it was one of the worst in sports. That was at the bottom of the sporting world. Right now, the Patriots are just in the bottom of the standings. You know, I mean, there's a difference. The Patriots have bottomed out in the standings. I still think that's a well-run organization.
Good point.
So, as far as the podcast, Mike, I'm often referred to the Mike Felger of the podcast, so I don't know what that means, but yeah. So, my question would be, what is going on? Because I think you share a view that I've had that I've been kind of touting on the podcast is just starting over. I mean, there should be no remnants of anything with Bill Belichick hopefully that decision is made. I think you agree with me. So what are your feelings on that?
So I think that that's what it should be, a clean break, but I don't think it will be. I get the sense, you know, I think that Kraft sort of tacitly promised the job to Gerard Mayo as much as you can. You know, you're not allowed to do that, but as much as you can give someone a wink and a nod, I think he gave it to Gerard Mayo to be the next guy. And I think he also made a commitment to Bill O'Brien. That's more than just a year. And if I had to guess it, that the plan next year is Gerard Mayo, head coach, defense, Bill O'Brien, offense. And that's what they're going with. And I think that's underwhelming. I think that's going to be a real hard sell to the fans. Because when you bottom out like they've bottomed out, you don't just make cosmetic changes and you don't go in-house. You know, when you bottom out, you start all over, as you said, Scott. You don't take the head coach that, you know, coached you to a 3-14 record and then turn the team over to his linebacker coach. Like, that's just not how it's done. Yet I think that, you know, I'm pretty confident in believing that that was the plan, except Kraft had it planned for 2 years from now. He'd go from Belichick to Mayo after Bill set the record in 2024. The problem is they bottom out in 2023 and the move has to be made now. So this was never the idea that Gerard Mayo takes over a bottoming out football team. The idea was that Gerard Mayo takes over a team that would be headed in the right direction, and it would just be sort of passing the baton.
Yep.
Gerard Mayo was never the blow-up guy. Well, now they're in a blow-up spot, so what do they do? And I think Kraft's in a little bit of a spot there.
Yeah, it does change. You just went with my next question. That does what's happened may dictate something totally different than what they were thinking if Kraft has the fortitude to actually make the decision what's right for the organization. Because I don't think any other decision for the organization other than starting all over again with all new people and all new views is the right decision.
I mean, again, you tell me, give me another example of a team that bottoms out. We have 4 straight years without a playoff win, 3 out of 4 losing records. 4th year, you go 3-14. And that team keeps their offensive coordinator, offensive system, and turns the team over to their linebacker coach.
I'm right there with you.
It's just not how it's done. It's just that would be, I think that would be a complete departure from how other teams have handled it. And maybe it's the right thing. Maybe the only example would be like the Steelers, where they went from Chuck Knoll to Bill Cowher to Mike Tomlin. That maybe, you know, I don't know if they bottomed out like I think the Patriots have bottomed out, but that might be the only example. Most every other team, every other organization in this league in sports.
He'd be gone already. He'd be gone already.
100%. If Belichick wasn't Belichick, he'd be gone already. You bet.
Jeez, you know, I try and be the positive one, but now with 2-on-1 here, I don't know how I'm going to handle this. So I'm going to harken back to some older times and talk about your tales from the sidelines you mentioned. You know, we always ask our folks, you know, could you tell us an untold Patriot story? Was there any that were left on the cutting room floor or any that you've come up with since their revision in 2017?
Any on the cutting room floor? I mean, I heard a bunch of salacious crap that I don't feel speaking into a microphone, like, you know, who's banging who and all that sort of stuff.
Don't be calling out Jason Veritek on
him. Not right. That was a mistake years ago. I'm not going to make that mistake again. So, no, I mean, nothing that if I had something good that I was comfortable saying in front of a microphone, I'd have said it. So I'm not going to. But it is, you know, I found it interesting. You know, one of the more interesting parts of Patriots history that I really find interesting and I think it was forgotten was the late 70s team and just how good that team was.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
And what sort of a larger than life figure that Chuck Fairbanks was. And it really, people forget because the Pats weren't popular like they are now and football isn't popular like it is now. So it's a little different, but Fairbanks was a little bit like Parcells before his time. And when he took over in the mid 70s there, the team was, you know, woe begotten. You know, it was as bad as it was, if not worse than when Kraft took over or Parcells took over in 94. And here comes Fairbanks and they got all these draft picks because they were able to trade Plunkett and Fairbanks made some other moves. And if you go back and look at the drafts in those 70s years, I mean, it's just like one after the next, one stud after the next.
Hit on everything.
I mean, it was just. And they were rolling, you know, that the Sugar Bear Hamilton year where they lose to the Raiders out there on that play. The Raiders won the Super Bowl that year. Was that 76?
76, yeah.
Yeah, so the Raiders win the Super Bowl that year. They had only one loss, and it was to you. It was to the Patriots. The Patriots beat them out here in Foxborough, I think. And then for some reason, they're out there in the playoffs. I can't remember how maybe the tiebreakers or whatever, maybe they finished with the worst record. You're out there. And they get screwed on a couple of plays and, you know, that's that. And then the next thing you know, 2 years later, Chuck Fairbanks is, taking jobs at the University of Colorado while he's still employed with the Patriots to the point where, you know, the Sullivan's
worse than Tuna leaving.
So it sort of mimicked it. Like, you know, 20 years later, Parcells kind of did the same thing. And I always found that the most interesting thing, how good that 70s team was, how it got derailed by Fairbanks, but how it all just sort of repeated itself with Parcells 20 years later. I mean, that's something that's in the book. That's something that's been told a lot, but I don't think folks appreciate just how good that team was and how similar it was to the Parcells thing and how that ended as well.
Let me follow up on that for a minute since you brought it up. That 76 game, you've talked to in the book, a couple of people like Hannah and folks thought it could have been fixed. Did you get the sense from some of them or do you think,
well,
Pendrith was above the level?
So you know, I'm sure Hannah must have said something like that because that's Hannah. But you know what they thought was just sort of the Raiders crap. Like there was a so again, this, you're putting me on the spot. I don't have it in front of me, but there was a third down play where Sam Cunningham ran out of bounds, or just, right. And he ran out of bounds just before the first down marker, or where the he ran out of bounds just before the first down. But that's because the guy with the marker, who was holding the marker,
exactly,
was standing 2 yards, you know, inside of where the first down was.
Yeah.
So Cunningham dipped out of bounds where the first down marker was, thinking he got the first down, not realizing it was 2 yards short of where it should have been. So is that cheating? Is that, you know, someone on the Raiders sideline moving that guy there? I mean, you know, somewhere in there. And then also they complained about, you know, that 76 Patriots team was fast and skilled. And they went there, and when they walked onto the field there in Oakland, the grass was 6 inches high and soaked. They had soaked the field the night before and let the grass grow, which again is that gamesmanship or cheating? Like that sort of stuff I remember them talking about. I don't remember them saying anything about Ben Drive.
Yeah. Okay.
So one of the things when I was going through when I was introducing you is there was a quote from David Creed in an article in the Nantucket Current that I wanted to throw in the beginning. But Michael Felger is also known for his fiery takes that aggravate and piss off many sports fans. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, so. That's about it. That's right.
So my question for you. So I'm a Milwaukee fan. You know, come from that area. Now, as far as Green Bay, they had a plan for quarterback, and I know you've talked about it quite a bit. How bad did the Patriots mess up that whole situation? I mean, from, you know, the situation that they had in Green Bay to elevate the quarterbacks there, how badly was this mismanaged from the beginning?
So badly and so surprising to me. I just thought, again, we talk about, I still think they're a good organization with good decision-making and long-term views. And, you know, not to be ahead of the quarterback thing to me is just, it's insane, especially when they did it. They started to do it with Garoppolo. And whether Garoppolo was the guy or not, there was a clear plan there. You draft a guy, you put him in the system, you put him behind Brady, you get him in the playbook, you get him in the coaching. And then after 2-3 years on the bench in the system, boom, that's the next guy. There's your transition. I like that approach. I always thought the Niners nailed it with Montana to Young, and I think the Packers have done it a couple times now with Favre and Rodgers, and I'm hoping that Jordan Love is that next in line. I feel like there's a chance for it to be that way, and I just think that's such a smart, thoughtful, patient way to go about it. And the Pats did it with Garoppolo, so I'm like, great, they've got this. And then after Garoppolo got traded, they never reloaded, and they let Brady walk out the door, and they've got nothing in reserve. And what happens is you then just take the last guy standing in free agency, Cam Newton, in June.
Right.
You realize he's not the guy. Then you take the last guy standing in the first round of the draft. He's not the guy. By the third year of him, he's so messed up, he can barely get out of his own way. You've messed around with the backup thing so much, you don't really have a backup. I mean, how many of their they've waived all their backups at some point in time.
Yep.
So I just think that they have butchered the thing badly. And it's surprising and disappointing because I thought they would be the last team, the last organization in the league to be flailing around at that position like this.
Yeah. So, I mean, you look at this year, I want to say the number is it's probably pushing 20 QB transactions for the year, especially now with Greer being claimed and then they signed somebody else. I mean, what do you think was up with the games with, you know, bringing them up, signing them to the 53, bringing them down? And it's just with what we've seen this year. I mean, if you do all that and you give that guy a chance to play, like they never even gave these guys a sniff at the field. So why would you manipulate transactions, you know, and even letting Malik go? You mean, and I know this is something you've talked about, you mean to tell me that they couldn't have let one of the 25 special teams players that don't do anything, they could have let him go to keep Malik?
Oh, my God. So you waive Bailey Zappe, who's your starting quarterback. You waive other backup quarterbacks, and then you look at the bottom of the roster, and your head wants to explode. Looking at some of those names, you know who they are or what they do. In a lot of cases, they do nothing. And
right.
And yet Bill dicks around at the quarterback because they were the most important position on the field. That's the position that's getting yanked on and off the roster to make roster space for, you know, extra cover guys, extra punt cover guys, extra offensive linemen, seventh defensive lineman. It's just there's no other team who handles quarterback like that because I think Bill's always sort of lacked a little bit of a touch at that position. And I feel like it's getting worse. I feel his touch at that position is getting worse.
But it's almost like, I mean, I hate to say it, but it's almost like a blatant middle finger to, you know, all right, you know, you wanted Mac Jones as your quarterback. And it's, I don't know. It just, it makes no sense. I mean, especially like you said, after the way the organization's been run, it just makes absolutely no sense.
Well, you know, and you raise a good point there, Scott. I don't think you can rule out that Bills has some vindictiveness there, or there's some sort of point behind what he's doing. You know, I mean, it took him forever to move on from Mac Jones. They should have made that move much sooner. So why do they keep throwing Mac Jones out there? Well, was Bill trying to prove a point to someone? Hey, Robert, you wanted this guy. This is your guy. All right, here we go. Or is he proving a point to Mac Jones, who, you know, you sort of left Bill's circle of trust last year, called outside the family. Hey, sure. Mac, you got all the answers. Hey, where's your coaching help now? I thought Patricia and Judge were the problem, Mac, huh? Right. Oh, okay. Yeah. No, well, let's see. Here you go. There, no, it's all like, is Bill proving some point there by keep throwing Mac Jones out there? Is he proving some point at the position that, I don't know, did Robert not let him go get a better backup this year? And so he's, you know, just exposing how bare they are at that. You can't rule that stuff out with Belichick, because he often makes decisions based on those sort of things.
Well, you're putting Scott in his glory right now, Mike. I got to tell you.
Thanks, Mike. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Anytime.
So he had mentioned at the beginning you're a Wisconsin guy, and when we had Maz on, we like to tailor it a little bit to our guests. And I talked to him about some baseball guys that were drafted that played for the Pats. So me and my crack research staff of me scoured the annals of Patriots history to find if anyone played for the Patriots was actually born in Wisconsin. And I found that there are 9. Can you name one?
Wow. God, I should know this. There are 9 that were born in Wisconsin.
And I'm going to tell you, it's not. There's not even a hint I can give you with these guys. If you don't get it, I'll let you off the hook.
Okay, so was Tony Simmons born in Wisconsin, or did he just go to Wisconsin?
Yeah, he was not born in Wisconsin. Yeah, well, there's a number of guys like James White, obviously,
right,
went
right.
to Wisconsin and such. But
oh God, you can't get. Can you tell me? Like, give me Let's the see, year
there,
of it.
There
team.
Was 3 in 1989.
Okay, I'm not going to get those. I'm not going to get the 3 and 9. Wait, who is the one that's on the team the latest? Like, who's the
2010? He was a center.
Was it Gray Rugemer? Or was he just a former Packer? Remember that guy?
Yeah,
I do. Yeah, no, the most recent was Matt Catula.
Okay, wouldn't have known that.
One year wonder here.
Yeah.
The first one was back in 63, was Tom Newman, the halfback. And I'll be honest with you, the only one I had heard of on the list was Jeff Dellenbach, who was a mid-90s lineman.
Right. So, but you got me.
Yeah. I'll let you redeem yourself with, what about a notable NFL player that was born in Wisconsin?
Well, Watt was actually born in Michigan, wasn't he? I think J.J. Watt was born in Michigan.
I think JJ and TJ were both born in Wisconsin.
Okay, they were. They were born in Wisconsin, but they went. One of them started at Central Michigan. So JJ Watt and his brother. Yeah, they're Wisconsin boys. Yeah, yeah.
Hall of Famers Joe Thomas, Jim Otto.
Joe Thomas. That's right. Okay.
Out there.
There's a bunch.
Yeah. Rocky Blyer.
Rocky Blyer. Was he born in Milwaukee?
It was in Wisconsin. I don't have the city.
Okay,
here.
So why he was a really popular guy in the '70s in Milwaukee. I remember that.
Okay. Yeah, right. I just thought I'd have a little fun
there
trivia.
You go. All right, I like it.
All right, so
back to my roots.
We'll close it out with this one, Mike. So you spend a lot of time in Nantucket, and so does another person that we've been talking about, Bill Belichick. Now I know you spent a lot of time with him when you wrote the book, and I think you've even joked about it on air, but. Not many interactions since then, right?
Nope. It's been over for about, I don't know, 15 years, call it.
All right. So in light of that, so we'll end this podcast with the story of you were in Nantucket, and a former Bruins player, who I guess didn't like some of the stuff you were saying on the radio, confronted you.
Yeah, I got a little tap on the shoulder. And this is the late Jimmy Hayes, who I really feel bad about his situation. He had some problems, and it came to an unfortunate end. And, you know, that's a bad story. But yes, he got a little tap on the shoulder and a talking to. He could not have been. He was nice, but it was a combination of confrontational but nice. About he bought me a beer,
okay,
and sort of said the stuff that he didn't like, and I explained to him. I think he's sort of misinterpreting what I was saying, but either way, I mean, the guy's like 6'7", you know, so it's just like
I mean, you are just a facilitator.
Oh, well, some, you know, I try to, that's why I try and facilitate. You actually try and give takes. There's someone going to tap you on the shoulder at a bar and say, I didn't like what you said. So you're much safer. Just facilitate. I'll stick to Wisconsin trivia. That's much safer.
Now, is that the only time that happened, or has it been other times that that's happened?
Oh, there's been, I mean, so outside of the locker room, that's one of the few times. I can't remember. Oh, there's been a couple off, you know, okay, I'll tell you a quick story if you want.
All right, there you go. Ben, we'll end it with this.
Ben, another Nantucket. I'm in Nantucket, fancy place. I see Ben Watson. He had left the Patriots by that point. And, he stands up, you know, he's Matt, 6'5", you know, fills a door frame, like, just like, yeah, so like everyone's looking at him, you know, so he stands up to walk out of the place. And I thought he sort of gave me a nod. And I sort of, like an idiot, took that as an entree, like, all right, I'll get up and say hi.
Yeah.
So I, and now everyone's looking at us because you can't, like, he just sticks out because he's so massive and chiseled. And he's there with his wife. And so I stand up and I first try and do the handshake, which I just always bang, you know, the dorky white guy trying to do the handshake with an NFL player. Awkward, doesn't work. I say, well, how's Cleveland? Have you settled in? You found a place? Yes. Cleveland. I said, yeah. Have you found school? I turned to his wife. Have you found a school? Have you found a place to live? Are you all settled in Cleveland? He sighs. He looks at me. He goes, You talk so much shit, man. You don't know what's coming out of your mouth. I'm in Seattle. I went to Seattle. That's where we are.
Wow.
Why don't you sit down and have dinner with your wife? And he walked out.
Oh, wow. And everybody's looking, right?
Everyone sitting around us is like, oh,
that hurt.
Oh. And there was a guy who sits behind us, who was sitting behind us, was actually the GM of Channel 5, who's a big guy in Boston, who we knew a little bit. And so he witnessed this whole thing, and I'm like, you know, I'm crushed. I'm like, oh my God, that was so embarrassing. And I turn and I look at that guy, and Bill Fine looks to me and says, that was the greatest thing I've ever seen in my life. So that's the last time I ever said hi to someone outside of a professional setting. Okay. No one wants to see me. No one wants to talk to me. If I've talked about them on the radio for more, odds are they can't stand the sight of me and hate my guts. So anything that, if I come up to them, like, get this fucking guy out of my face. So, if someone has to come to me and say hi to me, and then fine.
Yeah.
But that's the last time I make that mistake.
Now, see, that was an Untold Patriot story. That's how
there you
go.
There is one. That is clean. I could say that. That's a good one.
So, Mike, I can't thank you enough for taking the time at the end of the day, hopping on right after you just finished the show. Like I said, you were on the list of Boston legends we've had. We're knocking them out, and you were one of the few left. So I'm really glad that you could make the time to come on with us, and we appreciate your time.
Okay, my pleasure. You say legend makes me sound like I'm old and almost done, but that's very nice of you. I appreciate it. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Untold Patriot Stories with Scott Prusak and Dave Usher. Please follow us on whatever platform you download your podcasts, and be sure to tell your friends.